Thursday, October 1st, 2015. This is the Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Poke Runyon. And tonight we present the third in our series of lectures on the spheres of the Tree of Life, the seventh sphere, Netzach, the sphere of nature attributed to Venus and the home of the goddess Astarte. Netzach has been called the sphere of the mysteries and the womb of the creative process. The goddess herself is in the seventh sphere in that she contains all the spheres of the tree within herself and is thus the supreme initiator. Once again, we'll refer to the texts by Gareth Knight, Dion Fortune, John Michael Greer, and our own Hermetic Yoga Volume 1. So come join us for some deep meditations and reflections on the most intimate aspects of occultism. And now we'll start off with page 78 in Hermetic Yoga, describing Netzach. Netzach, the sphere of nature, Venus, Nogah. Netzach is the sphere of nature attributed to the planet Venus and the home of the goddess Astarte, who is also referred to as the Queen of Heaven. We venerate Astarte as the divine body containing all the roses and jewels of the Hermetic Caduceus. That's chakras to you people who are still eating curry. And as such, she becomes the supreme initiating priestess. And the jewels of Atargatas worn by the priestesses of her temple are their dispensation from the goddess herself to awaken and empower the psychic centers of her initiates. In her icon, she is shown for the original setting of the first seasonal drama, the source of the River Adonis at Afaka in the Lebanon. Come to us from far Afaka's spring enshrined and sacred tree, where roses bloom by lofty cedars, and a crimson river seeks the sea. And I'm quoting from the Adonia ceremony. Now you will note, if you're looking at the picture in the book, that the ox goat of Shamgar, the son of Kusor and Anath, is stuck in the sacred cedar tree behind the goddess. Now, to say that we worship the goddess Astarte would be misleading. In the Hermetic tradition, we only worship God, the Creator. All of the gods, goddesses, angels, and spirits are manifestations and agents of God's creation. This includes the ancient pagan dying gods and avatars such as Baal and Astarte, Melkart, Hercules, Osiris, and Isis, and even Jesus and Mary Magdalene. Because we consider the physical universe to be female, the Soma Sophia represents the celestial goddess, and Astarte is her terrestrial form. Astarte holds all of the psychic centers, the mystic jewels and roses, the chakras, within her body. And thus, we venerate her in a form of meditative worship akin to the Eastern practice of bhakti yoga, the yoga of worship. But for those who find this less than satisfying, we should remind them that God, as El or Al, in the Phoenician tradition, rules with his consort, Lady Asherat of the Sea, the Queen of Heaven, of which Astarte is considered the terrestrial aspect. Now, let me explain a little bit about two things. The icon of Astarte is the picture of Astarte at Afaka. And let me explain a little bit about this. Afaka is a spring, the source of the River Adonis in Lebanon. And it comes out of a cave, a grotto, and this waterfall falls down and then runs out to the sea, to the Mediterranean. Now, once a year in the rainy season, once a year in the springtime, the rains overswell the water table, and the River Adonis rises as the rushing waters go down toward the sea. And it rises and it hits a hematite layer stratification in the side of the gorge, and the river turns red. The river turns red, not exactly blood red, sort of a rusty red, but this is symbolic, as naturally symbolic of the dying god. In this case, a later version of Baal, known as Adon, who was supposedly, according to the last version of the legend, he was gored by a wild boar up there and up there at the spring, and the goddess, of course, tried to resurrect him. But the earliest version of this was the Adonia of Baal and Astarte, way back all around about 2000 BC. In this case, Baal is slain by the Dark Lord Mote, the Grim Reaper, and Astarte comes and promises to the faithful worshippers that she will return in the fall and resurrect Baal, and she will also battle with Mote and kill Mote. Well, we just finished doing that at Rivendell. We just finished our 41st presentation of the Festival of Seven Gates, in which Astarte comes down through all the seven gates of the underworld and resurrects Baal in the who is stretched out on his funeral bier, and she anoints his psyche centers and gives him the grail to drink, and with the honey mead seminal sacrament that revives him, and so he gets up and says, "I've not been dead, but only sleeping, hardly longer than a wink. I'll be up and rolling thunder once I've had another drink." And of course, that's my cue to roll the spring drum and create the thunder out there, you know, because I was running music and special effects for this. Astarte and Baal administer the sacrament to the celebrants, and that's the ceremony. Now, this ceremony is at this point is about 4,000 years old, and the reason why I mention this is that this is the origin, and this was, according to the anthropologist Jesse Weston, this was the origin of the original origin of the Holy Grail. Now, well, I also mentioned the jewels of Atargatis, and I wish we could show you the icon of Astarte here holding the grail and wearing the jewels of Atargatis, the harness. The jewels are positioned on the psychic centers, the seven psychic centers or chakras, going all the way from her forehead down to her another region, and they represent all of the major spheres of the Tree of Life going down the lightning flash. And the one we're discussing tonight is right at her solar plexus, and that's the seven pointed star of Venus, or Netzach. And that particular jewel is right at the solar plexus in this golden jeweled harness that the priestess wears. Now, let me continue with this description in the book here. You will note the ox goad of Shamgar, the son of Kusur, and Anath, stuck in the sacred tree behind the goddess. And you may, those of you regular listeners may recall that we have recreated the legend of Shamgar, I think he was the third judge of Israel, but he was a Phoenician pirate who rescued the Israelis, and according to the Bible, he slew 600 Philistines with an ox goad. In other words, he He set the pattern for the later Samson, who was another judge, who did it, who killed a bunch of them with the jawbone of an ass. But Shamgar came first and did it in 600 of them with an ox goad. Now, an ox goad looks kind of, it's a sort of a spike with a hook on it. And so we find that the Shamgar's ox goad stuck in the tree up there at Ephraka, and there's a story behind that, which we will tell at some future date. Okay. Now, to say that we worship the goddess Astarte would be misleading, and I think I read that over, and I said that we should remind that the god El, or Al, in the Phoenician tradition, rules with his consort Lady Asherat of the Sea, the Queen of Heaven, of which Astarte is considered a terrestrial aspect. Now, let's also remind you that in our antique tradition, we venerate El, Father El, and he is the original Most High God. And he's the Most High. He's the Most High God of Melchizedek, the Jebusite Canaanite high priest who gave Abraham his first communion, and Melchizedek means, by the way, priest king, and Melchizedek was certainly a Canaanite, and El was the father of the gods. Analogous in some ways to Zeus, he was, because he ruled from the top of Mount Zaphon, which was the sacred mountain in those days, in the Lebanon. Now, El was the Most High God, and he was always referred to as El the Compassionate. He had another name, Latipan, but he was always, whether Latipan or El, he was referred to as El the Compassionate. And this is quite different from Yahweh or Jehovah, who was certainly not compassionate. And in fact, I got a chance finally to see Ridley Scott's Exodus the other night, and Ridley Scott pictured Jehovah as a 12-year-old boy having a temper tantrum, and in many ways, I kind of that particular scene where Moses is really, really really upset about the plagues that Jehovah is bringing on the Egyptians, and he goes up the mountain and he tries to reason with this 12-year-old boy, Jehovah, and he tries to reason with him, and he says, I can't be a party to this anymore. I grew up with these people. This is horrible. You got to stop doing it. And whereupon the kid stomps his feet and goes into a tantrum and starts talking about how terrible the Egyptians are. And then he finally says, "And you haven't seen anything yet. Wait till you see what I'm going to do now." And of course, that was killing all the firstborn. So Jehovah was not the Most High God of Melchizedek. It was not the God of Melchizedek who blessed Abraham to start with. That was originally El, and it continued to be El. Half the books in the Bible are still what we call the lowest books. In other words, they're books in which El is God, and Jehovah got plugged in later. Ezra edited only the lowest books, and he stuck YHVH in there. Now, one of the reasons why this is important to the Netzach sphere that we're talking about tonight is because the Netzach sphere, according to the Kabbalah, it's Yahweh Zebaoth is the name of power in Atzeluth, but the choir of angels are the Elohim. Well, the Elohim, this is very appropriate, the Elohim, that's Elohist. And what I mean by that is the Elohim are plural. They are a plural and feminine. And so you have what they really could be translated. If you want the best translation of Elohim is the gods and the goddesses. And so Netzach partakes of both, except that in the case of applying Yahweh's veil, which of course we have changed to a Mashahoja veil because we don't use the YHVH tetragrammaton. We use a lowest tetragrammaton. So, but this is an example of Ezra's Jehovah-ing everything, but which really does not apply to Netzach. Netzach's the seventh sphere on the Tree of Life. I think you all know where that is. And it is directly superior to Hod. And this is also important because Netzach supplies Hod with natural forms, inspirations, and ideas in their natural form, and Hod, then the intellectual sphere, processes them into magical images, and then transfers them to Yesod, downloads them to Yesod, and where they take their final form, and then until they become actuated in Malkuth. And this is the process that comes down the lightning flash. Now, we say that Netzach is the sphere of nature. And in this case, we mean the forces of nature. Now, Dion Fortune, of course, in one of our texts, Dion Fortune is the mystical Kamala. And in this case, this is Dion Fortune is quite good on this, and she has really done a very thoughtful article on Netzach in her book. And one of the complicated things about this sphere, Netzach is a complicated concept, because what we're dealing with here is the formation of the Elohim, of the gods and the goddesses. And as Dion Fortune explains, and as we, most of us are aware, that ancient pagan gods and goddesses are personifications of forces of nature and particular aspects of human character that relate to those forces of nature. Dion Fortune goes into some detail about the idea that, where Hermes says, and I've quoted this, I don't know how many times in our lectures. Hermes says, man creates the gods of the earth sphere, and the gods of the zodiac are eternal. And Dion Fortune, extrapolating from that, deals with the idea that these personifications of natural forces and human characteristics that are influenced by those natural forces, that these are projected upward. If we're all down here in Malkuth, and also in Yesod, which is part of also Yesod, as you know, is the gateway to the astral, but part of it is still in the etheric. So what Dion Fortune is saying, in line with what Hermes is talking about, is the projection upward of these concepts, of the gods, the creation of the gods, and the idea of creating of enough people believing in these entities that actually, if enough people believe in them and enough people make images of them and enough people pray to them and make sacrifices to them and all of that, they actually can acquire a form of life, and they do. And they acquire a form of life, and an image, and they become an entity. In other words, we are creating our own gods and goddesses, and projecting them upward to be reprojected and formed downward. Now, this goes here again along with Hermetic principle: as above, so below; as within, so without. And as we say, Nosce te ipsum, know yourself. You are God to us, Deus. All of us. You can. This is a fair Hermetic analogy. The God spark in all of us, in all the whole human race, regardless of race, creed, color, whatever, the whole human race is actually, in a sense, one huge colony creature. You know, when I say a colony creature, like a Portuguese man of war, you know, a Portuguese man of war is that great big jellyfish with a sail, and it's made up. That creature is made up of millions of small little creatures, all hung together, and they make their own shape, and they have that sail and all those feelers hanging down and all that. So here's a whole bunch of creatures that get together, little creatures, and form a greater creature. And it's a perfectly good concept to say, especially because. Yes, it says in the Bible, and we also believe God created man in his own image, and conversely, man created God in his own image, because all of us together, all of these little divine sparks, all of us together form this great big colony animal called humanity, and so we are projecting upward. And God in turn is projecting downward, and this is a concept that, as I say, I encourage you to read Dionne Fortune's The Mystical Kamala, because she deals with this, and she also relates it in terms of modern psychology, and it's a very satisfying exposition. Let's talk a little bit about the different god forms that we deal with. For one thing, Netzach is the sphere of Venus, and the emblem of Venus is a seven-pointed star, a septagram. All right, that's 7 points, 7 days of the week, and the seven planets, and we have essentially seven main psychic centers or chakras, and a god form to go in each of them. Now, I know that in the Renaissance, European magicians favored a revival of classical Greek and Roman god forms. Now, that's fine, but unfortunately, what happened, even though that was very popular in the Renaissance with Pacino and it got so popular that it got to be kind of blasé, and Giordano Bruno even wrote a satire on it, called The Triumphant Beast, in which he actually said, "What are we worshiping all these Greek gods for? They're a bunch of hooligans, you know. They're not very moral, and they're not very virtuous, and all of that." Anyway, he was making a good point there, except that these ancient pagan gods, even though they were capricious and all of that, Most of their picadillos and their activities were pretty good mirrors of human activity, and in some cases were actually based on it, because sometimes great heroes in the past became the became the templates and the archetypes for the gods themselves. Now, let's ask why, and it's a good question, why do we in the OTA, why do we use the ancient Canaanite gods, and why do we use them in preference to the classical pagan deities that the Renaissance magicians used? Well, I wrote a little section here in the Hermetic Yoga book to explain that. In approaching this Western Hermetic version of Tantric Yoga, one might ask, why do we employ the ancient Canaanite or Phoenician pantheon? Should we not follow the lead of the Renaissance Hermetic magicians and resurrect the classical pagan deities of the Greco-Roman period, as in their use of the Orphic hymns and astrological planetary assignments? Now, we could have done so, but it would have been somewhat anachronistic because the Renaissance neoclassic revival of Hermetic magic went through a Kabbalistic and then a Rosicrucian and finally a Masonic phase. Now, let me repeat that slowly and put some dates on it. Because the Renaissance neoclassic revival, that was the ancient, originally that they were talking about Ficino and Campanello and the rest of them, and Bruno, they were talking about the ancient Greek and Roman gods. The neoclassic revival of Hermetic magic, but then it went through a Kabbalistic phase. That's when they didn't really start to deal with the Kabbalah in a Renaissance, the Renaissance magicians, until Pico della Mirandola and in the late 1400s and von Rosenroth, who gave us a Latin version of the Zohar, So then they began to deal with the Kabbalah in magic, and of course that was primarily angels and it's got to be very biblical, and then it went into a Rosicrucian phase. Well, that's frankly the Rosicrucian phase was a result of the Reformation and whatever. The attempt to create a mythology based upon Christian Rosencrucians, and also in the Rosicrucian phase, the Kabbalah was Christianized, so we got further on. So we started moving from the classical. Revival of the classical Greek gods and goddesses into the Kabbalah, and then into a biblical phase, and then finally we move past the Rosicrucians, and Freemasonry became the environment in which Hermetic magic flourished. Now, when we reach the Masonic phase, we are at that point. We are very, very much into the legendary version of Solomon's Temple. Well, most of you are aware that Solomon's Temple was built primarily, the idea of the Masonic idea is we celebrate the building of Solomon's Temple and the tragedy or the murder of the architect, which is very much like the crucifixion of Jesus. In fact, the raising of Hiram Abiff has been called a Masonic version of raising Jesus' return from the dead, but. The Masonic legend of Solomon's Temple leads us into the whole Canaanite pantheon behind behind the Bible, because Solomon, as I'm sure everybody who listens to this show is aware, Solomon also built a temple to the goddess Astarte, and Hiram of Tyre, the king of Phoenician Tyre, helped in the building of the temple, and the architect Hiram Abiff was half Jewish and half Phoenician, and so what the behind the Masonic aspect of this lies the return to the ancient gods. In fact, there's even legends where Solomon used the jinn or the spirits, some people might call them demons, to help build the temple. And so the whole school in the late Middle Ages and in the late Renaissance, there was a school of Solomonic ceremonial magic, which we have also revived. So behind all of this, behind Solomon and his legend, lies the Canaanite pantheon, and Baal and Astarte and Father El, very definitely, because Solomon, even though Ezra in his rewrite of the Bible makes Solomon seem to be a Yahwehist, actually Solomon was very much an Elohist, and very much his, as far as Solomon was concerned, it was the Most High God of Melchizedek, and which is the Phoenician and the Canaanite supreme God. Now, to continue with this, along with tales, the legends surrounding King Solomon and the building of his great temple, along with tales of Jesus and his Holy Grail and Christian Rosencruz, became more important to magic than the Greek and Roman myths of an earlier era. The ancient gods behind the Solomonic tradition and Gnostic Christianity were the old gods and goddesses of the Middle East. They fit on the spheres of the Kabbalistic tree of life. They were cognate with both the Greek and the Babylonian deities. Astarte was both Aphrodite and Ishtar. Baal was Hercules and Jesus. Since the 17th century, magic has been linked with the Bible via the Kabbalah, Masonic Solomon, and the Arthurian tradition of the Holy Grail. More recently, we can add the Ear King and the Horn God and the Eternal Goddess of the Wiccan tradition to our list of similar deities and related mythical lore. This is why we venerate the ancient pre-biblical deities and legends that lie behind these great magical themes. So you should get to know these ancient archetypes, bring them to life within you, and they will be your friends and your helpmates. And just as the old Hindu and Bunpo gods and demons in Tibetan tantric practice are aspects of Buddha, ours are all aspects of Father El and Mother Asherah, and so would it ever be. Now, when I say aspects of El and Mother Asherah, Let's be clear about this. There is a problem both with the Elohists and with the Yahwehists that somewhere or other they lost the goddess, and they lost the goddess, and if you really want to understand the symbolism of the universe, realize that you can't have one without the other, because the universe itself is female. Yeah, the universe is female, and the Soma Sophia is the great starry vault. The Egyptians called her Nuit, and you remember she arches her body over the earth, and as if she's doing a big push-up, and she's arching her body over the earth, and all the stars, the zodiac constellations, are all part of the body of the great goddess of the heavens. and she's referred to as the Summa Sophia. And this, so yes, God can be in a creative sense, in the sense of the Big Bang, God can be thought of as a male creative force in the womb of a male creative force which will impregnate the womb of Summa Sophia and create the worlds and the suns and all, but they have to be within her body. Now, in our sacred marriage ceremony, Astarte comes forth and says, "With this silver cup of mystery from beyond the veil of night, come I to take the rainbow in my shrine of hidden light." Now, this is one of the key lines in the sacred marriage. Now, that very much concerns Netzach, because in Netzach we place a very, very, very gigantic goddess Astarte. And the way we conceive that temple in our path workings and in our yoga, we conceive of her temple on the island, in the sea, the island garden with the carp pools and the doves and the roses and this beautiful temple. And in the middle of this round temple, with its columns and its veils, is a tank like a bath of living water. And the goddess sits in a yoga seat, in a lotus seat, in this tank of living water. And she sits there, and you can see her. She's sort of translucent. And we can imagine her as about 50 or 60 feet tall. And you can see all of the psychic centers through her translucent skin. You can see the jewels going up and up and up and up and up. Now, in one of our path workers, which is available to you associate members who have done your lessons, you know, you can order your path working video and you can do this. You can go down into the pool of living water and go down and dive down and swim right up inside the goddess. Well, that sounds a little risque, but you know, swim up inside the goddess and then have the supreme experience of doing the master ritual, not inside yourself this time, but inside the goddess this time. And this, I can tell you, is a wonderful experience. If you do this properly, meditate, and go up the psychic centers inside the goddess and meet all the gods and goddesses inside. And it's especially interesting when you get up to Netzach in the solar plexus. It's especially interesting because there you meet a smaller goddess version of the goddess inside herself. And I can tell you this particular type of path working or this particular type of meditation is really, really remarkable. And now, those of you who have a picture of our scroll, we call the scroll Judy because it was originally based on a lady named Judy. She's deceased now, bless her heart. But anyway, you look at Netzach and the seven-pointed star there with a Daleth in the middle of it. That's a seed letter. And you notice that the angel, the name of power in Atzilut going down is Amasha Ozebeoth, and that's we're replacing Yahweh with Amasha, which is a 24 letter tetragrammaton, but coming back up, we're going to open up with the angel. And the angel for covering Netzach is Haniel, H-A-N-I-E-L. Now, Haniel, I want to make a little correction here on John Michael Greer and his article on Netzach. He says that he can't find any mythology, anything interesting about Haniel that's worth reading. But I can't understand why John can't find anything, because I'm sure he has a copy of Davidson's Dictionary of Angels. And if you look in Davidson and look up Haniel, you will discover that Haniel was the archangel that lifted Enoch up to heaven for his revelation. And that certainly relates to this whole Netzach thing, because all of this, the psyche centers, the planetary spheres, all of them are a part of the original Enochian vision. And I don't confuse that with Ian Kelly's Enochian. I'm talking about the Book of Enoch, where Haniel lifts. That's not specifically in the Book of Enoch, but it is a legend that Haniel was the angel that carried him up to heaven. One of the things about each of these spheres or chakras is has a name of power in Atzilut that opens it up as you come down from the top, following the lightning flash, and as you go back up, it's opened up. You go on into the sphere using the name of the archangel. So if you're starting from the bottom here, we come down, we come all the way down that's down at Malkuth, and then we kickstart the Kundalini and we start going up, and we go up to Yesod, and we intone Gabriel, and then we go up to Ad Mikael, and then we go on up to Netzach Haniel, and we go on in. Now, In the sphere of Hod, as we discussed last time, this is where Kusor, the blacksmith, Tubal-Cain, has his workshop, and this is the sort of the sphere of the intellect, and it's a science, the sphere of science. And as Dionne Fortune describes it, she says that Netzach is the sphere of art, and Hod is the sphere of science. And so what's happening is the art, the idea, the talent, the art comes down from Netzach into Hod, where it is rationalized and made scientific, and then transferred from there down to Yesod, where it's actually given its where it's glued together and given a coat of paint, and then sent down to Malkuth, where we can buy it on the showroom floor. Yeah. So the idea of Netzach as this place where the ideas that have been projected upward by this great, each one of us alone. But somehow or other, when I remember I said that we were that God could be thought of in our sense, God could be thought of as a colony animal made up of all the little divine sparks of all the human beings. But the interesting thing about that, the corollary about that is that if you have really understood, and if you have attained what was referred to as enlightenment, then you are actually in contact at some level. We like to use the level of Carl Jung's collective unconsciousness is a good level to put it at. You are actually, once you receive hermetic enlightenment, you are or should be in contact with all of the whole colony animal, the whole thing. Because the whole thing is God, and each one of these little sparks is a sensor. And we can say, you could say that we are the 100 million eyes of God, but we're also the mouths of God, the hands of God, the nose of God. And we're here. And one of the aspects of Hermetic philosophy is that we are here to appreciate God's creation. And if we're appreciating God's creation, that means we are God, because, you know, God has a right to appreciate His creation, and He, according to some aspects of philosophy, He created us to appreciate it, and we're trying as hard as we can, not only to appreciate it but also to preserve it, because we were originally, you know, made stewards of the earth, not conquerors. We're stewards of nature. Now, Netzach has also been called the sphere of the philosophers grade in the Golden Dawn, because the philosophical aspects of it are that it is very fluid, and these ideas are very fluid, and these creative ideas are in formation, and they are flowing from Netzach down into Hod, where they get rationalized and made scientific. Doesn't this sound like what's going on in human nature all the time? It really does. I mean, when you think about it, you take all these beautiful, wonderful ideas, and as soon as the intellectual get a hold of them, they become made into something that is not quite as beautiful as it's originally intended, quite often. But this creative force of nature, and Netzach is, as I say, the sphere of nature, and the sphere of nature and natural philosophy. Now, I wanted to reveal a little bit. Dion Fortune has a little section in here that I would like to read to you, because I think it's very elegant. And let me read this sort of in summary here. Netzach in the microcosm represents the instinctive emotional side of our nature, and Hod represents the intellect. Netzach is the artist in us, and Hod is the scientist. According to our moods, shift between restraint and dynamism will be the polarity of Hod and Netzach in the microcosm, which is the soul. If there is no Netzach influence to introduce a dynamic element, the overpreponderance of Hod will lead to all theory and no practice in occult matters. No one can handle magic in whom the sphere of Netzach is not in function. For the skepticism of Hod will kill all magical images before their birth. Like all things in nature, Hod, unfertilized by its opposing polarity, is sterile. There must be something of the artist in every occultist who wants to do practical work. The intellect alone, however powerful, does not confer powers. It is through the Netzach in our own nature that the elemental forces obtain access to consciousness. Without Netzach, they remain in the subconscious sphere of Yesod, working blindly. It is taught in the mysteries that each level of manifestation has its own ethic or standard of right and wrong, and what we must not and that we must not confuse the planes by expecting from one the standard of another, which is not applicable thereon. In the realm of the mind, the ethic is truth. On the astral plane, which is the sphere of the emotions and the instincts, the ethic is beauty. We must learn to understand the righteousness of beauty as well as the beauty of righteousness. Oh, that's a good one, isn't it? We must understand the righteousness of beauty as well as the beauty of righteousness. If we want to bring all the provinces of the inner kingdom into obedience to the central power of unified consciousness. In entering upon the region of the four lower sephirot, we are coming into the sphere of the human mind, subjectively considered, that constitute the personality and its powers. It is the aim of the occult initiation to develop these powers, and if taken from the higher standpoint, as it always should be, it is not to degenerate into black magic, to unite them with Sephiroth, which is the focusing point of the higher self or individuality. And that is a good place for us to conclude this evening's lecture, because next week we are certainly going to be in Sephiroth. Unless, of course, we had Kerem Al-Kusa the week before, maybe if Pope Francis decides to pay us a visit, we'll interview him. But if not, we will do Tipperath, that's the sphere of the sun, and of course the sphere of the Redeemer, the sixth sphere. And so, until then, may the sun shine upon you, and next week, and we'll be there for Tipperath. And until then, good magic.